Good morning, this is Mitchell Thomas for the Downstairs Care Out There blog. I'm here today talking with David Still for our second attempt at making a podcast. Today, David's going to talk about some work he did for a poster for the SPA conference up on the Gold Coast that's just happened quite recently. And he's going to tell us a little bit about what he learned at the conference. Good morning, David.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, mate. Yourself?
Yeah,
I'm
pretty good.
All moved in and set here, so it's great. That was hectic. So, tell us about what you did in relation to the Good Sam app and crowdsourcing CPR.
Yeah, so there was a student paramedics poster competition going on at the SPA conference where students had to independently produce a research poster. So I thought, well, a topic that's going to be manageable would be smartphones and cardiac arrest, because that concept's only been around for about 3 or 4 years. And it was only mooted a year or two before that in review articles. So I ended up reviewing the evidence for whether smartphone apps can actually speed up the chain of survival, that is early access, early CPR, early defibrillation, early advanced life support. So that was actually a fairly specific search term in the end, and only 10 results came back, one of which was a duplicate. So we end up with only 9 articles, and of those 9 articles, not even all of them were peer-reviewed. So I think when you were only looking at the peer-reviewed data, only about 6 papers were peer-reviewed. And I guess the net results, so if you wanted the executive summary straight up the front, the net results are nobody's really studied this. These apps appear to work, and we don't know what the harms or the risks are. And that's it.
Lovely. So it's basically like everything else that's bouncing around the phone world at the moment.
Yeah. So there are definite similarities with other interventions as well. Absolutely.
Okay. So do you think there's obviously a market for further research then?
Oh, yeah. So there are some really interesting questions that were raised from this. So from that executive summary, they appear to work, and the uptake among users who use these apps is interesting. So we know from Stephen Brooks, who was reporting on the PulsePoint app in the US, that a massive proportion of the early users of these apps are people who already perform CPR as part of their daily work. So like a third of PulsePoint users at the time he reported were firefighters, 20% were paramedics, another 15% were EMTs, and some were nurses as well. So that's an extremely large proportion of early users who are already professionally experienced with CPR. And there was a similar study among, a service called AED Alert in the Netherlands, which found that only about a third of people who were using that that app were medically employed, but most people were actually trained by an emergency medical service as well. So it's interesting to see whether that level of experience can improve the chain of survival in ways other than time to defibrillation as well, like supporting bystanders or providing education as well. And those questions haven't been answered yet.
Yeah, I think one of the issues here is it's still a fairly young topic. Smartphones are still fairly new to the arena, and we're probably not going to see good research for at least 10 years on that, I'd say.
That's right. And I mean, even with very huge apps, cardiac arrest is not the world's most common medical emergency. So you have to wait some time to get good data, and that's okay. Interestingly, so you mentioned that smartphones are only very new. There were some apps that attempted to use old school phones using SMS text messages, and they seemed to work as well. So those were some of the ones with the really good data about how quickly we arrived and how quickly we provided CPR and how quickly we got shocks into people. But the interesting part is that SMS isn't really the world's most reliable technology. So it turns out that only about 50% of the time when you send an SMS text message to someone within 1,000 meters of a cardiac arrest, will they actually read it within a minute of receiving it? For various reasons, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of times that the phone's been going crazy in my pocket and I've just left it because I was doing something more important, or I was
Yeah, that's right. Or times when the text message has arrived hours later.
Yeah.
Which happens frequently with my mobile phone provider.
You need to get a Vodafone. That's your problem.
They do start with V, but they're not Vodafone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But even in those cases, even where SMS text messages were being used, there were really good conversion rates between the number of people who responded and the number of people who actually arrived and actually started CPR. So this study by Matthias Ring in Stockholm found that about 50% of the time, there was when they sent people to a job, there was an actual cardiac arrest occurring and the layperson arrived first, and about a third of those cases, they would actually start CPR. And that's pretty good. That's definitely better than the alternative, which was zero. The problem is, even with that kind of conversion rate, even with that kind of suggested efficacy, sort of surrogate outcomes, we don't actually know whether that converts into people living. Mm. And that's still something that needs to be answered as well.
Mm. I mean, that would probably come out of, hopefully, if we get bigger trials on pre-hospital CPR and things like that, that could hopefully be tacked into that. It'd be interesting to
That's
see.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we know that bystander CPR relates oftentimes to better outcomes.
That's right. Yeah. So I think the last I read was that a bystander who provides CPR gives their patient about four times the chance of surviving compared to one who just stands there. And that's pretty important. But on the other hand, you can also kind of imagine that someone arriving on the scene could be disruptive compared to someone who was already at the scene and already providing CPR. And when apps allow literally anybody to sign up, so GoodSam, for instance, allows anyone with a CPR certificate to sign up, I suppose it's possible that you could actually have worsen outcomes depending on the circumstances. And we don't know how often that would happen or whether that's actually a risk worth worrying about.
Well, that's it. I suppose then it all comes down to how the team that arrives on scene manages their patient and how they manage their interactions with each other and whether or not they can put aside differences and different skill levels and all get on the same page to deliver that good patient outcome that they're looking for.
Exactly. I think education probably is part of the way of handling that. But again, that's just a question we haven't been able to answer yet. Of all of these studies I found, of including all 10 of them, even the non-peer-reviewed ones, I think only one or two actually studied adverse effects, and they didn't actually study adverse effects to anyone else but the person who responded. And out of that, they only found that about 10 of the people who responded over the course of a few months, so 800 or so people, only about 10 of them actually needed supportive care after the job themselves, and only two actually received it. So that's really the information we have. All we know is how often people need help after these jobs in one study. Mm. And so that would be useful information to have in future studies as well.
I have another question for you. In the Matthias paper, did that just activate bystander CPR, or did that advise of a nearby defibrillator as well when activating via SMS?
So with Matthias Ring's papers, he's actually had two papers. They have done it a couple of different ways. It looks like they've continued to study the same service in Stockholm as it's evolved over time. So what they first did was use a simulation where they would just text people to tell them to go to a certain address and then time how long they'd get to that address. So that's sort of a CPR-only sort of thing.
Yep.
They would also then move to the real-life study where they'd judge jobs to be actual cardiac arrests and then compare them to certain criteria. So they had to be in a public place. I think they had to be during daylight hours. They preferred daylight hours, but they didn't have to be. And then they dispatch in the time how long they got there and see how often they beat the ambulance. So again, that was CPR only unless they already had defibs on them. I don't think most of them did. There was a second paper, I think by Scholten, who was studying the Netherlands and one of the systems they used there, where their text message responders actually were issued AEDs and would actually respond with those.
Okay.
And that was actually pretty hilarious to me, because that doesn't happen in Australia to start with. So that was a bit of a surprise. But also, even then, most of the time, the text message responder's AED wasn't the one that was connected to the patient, because there were so many publicly available AEDs, there was usually one already attached to the patient by the time the text message responder got there.
Okay. Yeah.
So they really have the best of both worlds. They have people running around with defibrillators and receiving text messages to go to cardiac arrests. And they've also got so many public AEDs that was almost redundant in a number of jobs. Yeah. So in his study, I think there were a total of 52 patients for whom that system was activated, and 7 of those 52 received defibrillation earlier than they would have from just the ambulance.
Okay. Well, that's a benefit.
Yeah. So 7 out of 52 is not a huge number, but those seven patients may have survived with a good neurological outcome compared to where they would have been before. And while we don't actually know whether that's an improvement, we haven't been able to test whether this improves survival rates. From what we know, it's likely to, and that's a great outcome.
I mean, from what we're traditionally taught, it's likely to, isn't it? But
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Who knows? More importantly, how was your poster received at the conference?
So there were, I think, 9 entries, and I actually thought it was a pretty strong field. One ballsy individual decided to tackle the concept of adrenaline in cardiac arrest, which is way braver than I'd ever attempt.
Yeah, that's bigger than me.
Yeah, it's bigger than her. And I think she actually won. I think that was the winning poster.
Well done.
I came second. Yeah, and definitely good effort. It was a really good poster. I came second, and a friend of mine, Paramedic Pirate, I think Paramedic Pirate on Twitter, Alicia Armstrong in real life, did quite well as well. And all of those posters, I think all of them, were posted on the Australasian Journal of Paramedicine in the last month or so, in the proceedings of the SPA conference.
Oh, brilliant. I'll have to try and dig them up and put them in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Embarrassingly, I think I'm the only one who actually submitted the text version of the abstract, because that's what they asked for. Everybody else submitted the actual poster. Mine's the one that doesn't look like a poster, although I can provide that too.
Okay, there we go. Well, I might get you to send that to me, and we'll put that up.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, lovely. So, well-received poster, had a bit of a chat about crowdsourcing CPR, and obviously this would be a good time to plug the Good Sam app if you're in Australia, if you're listening to this. It's on iPhone and Android now. Go and just download yourself a copy of the Good Sam app and have a play with it, have a look at it, register yourself as a responder, and get your family and friends and partners involved, because obviously that's our Australian version of crowdsourcing CPR there, and that's come out of England. Are you a Good Sam responder?
So I'm registered on Good Sam and I have Pulse Point for the curiosity value. Interestingly, my phone is so old, it seems to forcibly quit Good Sam from time to time, so I'm not always online. So I may need to get a new phone that doesn't do that.
Yeah, that's a bit of a disadvantage, isn't it? I think I have a Pulse Point account as well, because I was looking at it back when it was solely the responsibility of, I think it was San Francisco Fire first started it up. And
yeah,
that was the only area that they were running it in. I believe now it's gotten much bigger than just San Francisco Fire.
Yeah, so I think they've got as many as 100 services now.
Oh, wow.
Available. And there was a news article I saw the other day that they're in talks with Ambulance Victoria to roll out as well. And I wouldn't expect that to happen anytime soon, or to happen to the whole of Victoria all at once. But it'll be interesting to see how it works in an Australian context as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've already got... Pulse Point knows how to do it. They know how to integrate their Pulse Point dispatch system into CAD.
Yeah,
quite well. So I think I heard a podcast a number of years ago, probably on one of the older American EMS podcasts, like the Medic Cast or something like that, that was an interview with the gentleman that set up Pulse Point. And that was actually quite interesting. I wonder if it's still out there.
Because so that might have been the EMS 12 lead.
Possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
It was one of the older podcasts that unfortunately no longer exists.
Okay, yeah. So I remember Tom from EMS 12 lead was definitely talking with someone about it, and that's one of the things they discussed. And I think there is one more really interesting opportunity that hasn't been explored for these apps as well, especially something like GoodSam might be useful for crowdsourcing dispatch at really large events. So what I'm thinking of is, for instance, at the Canberra 100 Festival last year, we had at one point about half the population of the city in and around the CBD being covered by 50-odd St. John volunteers and half of the ACT ambulance service, because it's a small town, you throw everything at it. And so we ended up with this interesting situation where the phone networks were actually surprisingly stable. They were doing fairly well, and had a cardiac arrest occurred — one didn't on the day, but had one occurred — we may have found out about it first from the app before we were told by the ambulance dispatch service, because of the communications lag. So it would be interesting to see whether these kinds of apps could be adopted in a reliable way by volunteer organizations like St. John or the Red Cross or whoever, or even private ambulance services, to improve their own response times as well as the traditional ambulance services.
Just as a large event call bypass, really?
Yeah, and obviously it would depend really heavily on things like network stability.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, if we're using phone communications for other things as well, then that's no different.
Well, that's it. I mean, it probably wouldn't work in for New Year's in Sydney, because I think reliably, without fail, every year the phone network goes down right on 12 o'clock.
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, but it'd be interesting to see whether there are situations where that could work, and if so, we could work out which ones they are.
Absolutely. So the conference that you attended primarily was the SPA conference, the Student Paramedics Australasia.
Yep, that's correct.
Lovely.
Yeah, so that was great. So this was, I think, the first one I've been to where it's been run alongside the PA conference. This year it was called PAKE 2014. Same venue, everybody co-locating, everybody doing the same things, and it was great. It was an absolutely fantastic experience.
So the two conferences ran concurrently?
Yep. So the SPA conference was just on the Saturday, and the PA conference was much longer, a couple of days beforehand as well.
Oh, good.
But the student pre-hospital workshops were on the same days as the PA conference workshops. So there was a fairly good mixing of people at those as well.
Brilliant. And that's what we need, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I think there were a group of first-year University of Western Sydney students who went to the Paramedics Australasia Advanced Airway Workshop, which is, I think, the bravest thing I've ever heard a student paramedic do.
Yeah,
that's very exciting.
That's a good show.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't have done that as a first year, but
no, neither would I. But I think they got a lot out of it, and I think Buck Reed is their lecturer and should be very proud of them.
Oh, good. I think he probably pushed them in the door.
That's right.
So what kind of stuff was covered at the students' conference for you?
Yeah, so there were a couple of really good sessions. I only got to see a few, but I think probably my favorite was Ambo Foam talking about FOMED. That was pretty good and fairly well received. There were people signing up for Twitter in the middle of the talk about that. That was very exciting.
Good.
Yeah.
Spreading the love.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And hopefully that becomes a thing. I would like to see that become quite popular, because I think Twitter is a really good way to get student engagement up in the undergraduate degrees, when it can be quite easy to feel disconnected from what you're actually studying. If you're only actually on clinical placement for a couple of weeks a year, it's quite easy to just feel like this isn't really what you do now.
Yeah. I mean, when I was going through uni, we did two placements of 3 weeks each, and there was definitely a feeling of disconnection with the industry. Because at everything we went to, we were kind of just tacked on to the end. If we went to a conference, you know, you'd be that group of students sitting right up the back, not asking any questions, not saying anything. But I think of value to you guys is that the whole attitude towards student paramedics has changed in the recent years. especially in people that you see at conferences.
Yeah.
Because you deliberately, by going to conferences, you're deliberately seeking out those motivated individuals that want to deal with students and want to pass on their knowledge.
Mm, that's right, yeah. So there were other really good sessions as well there. So there was a really good one on pre-hospital amputations. There was some good physiotherapy input as well on musculoskeletal injuries.
Oh, good.
Those were the three that I got to see. I didn't get to see any others because I was busy.
And what were you doing? You were part of the organizing?
No, I wasn't organizing whatsoever. I don't even have that excuse. I was sleeping off the previous day's Furno Sim.
Ah, lovely.
Which was probably the most exhausting thing I've ever done, even though the actual scenario only took 15 minutes.
Probably felt like an hour.
Oh, yeah. And being sequestered, I think, was just as exhausting as well, because we had to stay separately in a room, just running through things in our heads 5,000 times while we waited to go as well. So that was absolutely exhausting, but very worth it.
Oh, good, good. So what was Furno Sim like for the ACU team?
So actually, we had two ACU teams, which made things confusing because we were just ACU 1 and 2 and we didn't know which was which. But it was great. So we'd had the chance to practice at uni among ourselves for the weeks leading up to it, because our lecturers wanted to come and see how we went as well. So they gave us free rein of the simulation rooms.
Brilliant.
To challenge ourselves. And one lesson learned from that is if other student teams want to do that in the future, they should definitely go for it. But I do think it is absolutely worth having a lecturer sit in and watch, because it's quite easy to finish a scenario, start debriefing, and then say to yourselves, actually, we don't know what we could have done better there. We felt comfortable with most things, but surely something went wrong, for instance. So definitely having lecturer input or another paramedic or even another student just to sit and watch is definitely the way to go.
I think with any kind of self-directed training or self-directed learning, if you're performing a scenario, you definitely need someone who's not involved in the scenario at all, not even playing a bystander, just someone to sit in a chair in the corner, watch, and provide guidance and feedback, who they just need to be completely uninvolved in the scenario for the sole purpose of providing that feedback.
That's definitely right. I think actually the evidence leans fairly heavily in that direction as well, but students being students, we didn't have the resources, and that's something we'll definitely hope to improve on next year as well.
Well, there you go. That's a lesson learned.
Yeah, on the day, I think we felt fairly well prepared for the scenario we were faced with. So we were shuffled into the back of a Queensland ambulance with curtains all across the front, so we couldn't see what was happening out the front, and then dispatched to a fall from height. All we knew was that a man had fallen from height, and that was it. As we walked out, we saw a man on the ground at the bottom of a ladder, like a 3-meter-tall ladder, lying supine and not moving, and at the top of the ladder was another man, supine, not moving, with blood coming out of his leg. So the scenario turned out to be that the man at the bottom of the ladder was diabetic and had become hypoglycemic while working, and had become unconscious, knocking over the ladder on which his co-worker was working, with a chainsaw lopping off limbs from a tree. So his co-worker had fallen, been injured by his chainsaw on the way down, and probably also, I think, had either a fractured shoulder or a fractured arm. So, fractured humerus. So, that scenario was one where we were faced with one patient who was subtle and not obvious at all, but still needing urgent and very definitive treatment. And a second patient who was also urgent, but much more obvious as a distraction as well.
Wow.
So, yeah, and we also had to practice making the scene safe. The chainsaw was still there and still running, so we had to safely move the chainsaw away, make the scene completely safe, get the patient off the ladder that they were lying on top of, for instance. So after all of that, I think our team did fairly well, but I think it was CQU who won, and as I understand it, they absolutely smashed the scenario.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
good for them.
Yeah, no, I think for us it was really good to be challenged to perform a scenario that was well within our scope of practice, but was very challenging for our reasons.
I mean, that sounds like it'd put anyone under strain.
Yeah, so a scenario at university might be 3 students to 1 patient, and that 1 patient might be really interesting. They might be having a STEMI or have a gunshot wound or something like that. This was 2 patients and a difficult scene. We don't normally get challenged with the logistics of a job as well as the clinical stuff.
No, so, and I mean,
that was the value for us.
That's half our job, really, is I've found
that's right.
More and more it's less the medicine I need to think about, more how am I actually going to get this person out of this 1930s cottage with 3 90-degree twists in the stairs.
That's right, yeah.
When they're 6 foot long.
Yeah, and it was quite similar in a way to a sim challenge that ACU ran internally last year, where we were doing the same old ordinary jobs like a fractured neck of femur, but the difference was that fractured neck of femur was head down in a stairwell. So that's where we had to do the exact same job. And I think that challenging students to work through the logistics of a job is just as important and useful to them as the clinical stuff as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and figuring out how to use your equipment in different ways to how you usually would. And
yeah, that's right.
You know, all the little tricks of the trade, not cutting corners, but how to use your equipment in ways other than what's on the catalog.
Yeah. So I think from our scenario, one challenge we had was we only had 1 drugs kit. So which patient gets the drugs kit? Because they were 3 or 4 meters apart. You couldn't just place it halfway between, because you'd still be running backwards and forwards.
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure we came up with a good solution to that. But in the end we were just sort of running between things.
Yeah. One thing I do is our drugs kits are set up so we have all the drugs down in the bottom of the kit that lies flat on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you open up the lid, all our cannulation supplies are in there. And that cannula board can be removed. But what I've taken to doing now is stowing some, like just a Ziploc bag of extra cannulation gear, just enough to do one cannula. So that if we come to a situation now where we have 2 patients and they're separated via distance, I can take the bag of cannula supplies and my partner can keep the more critically injured patient gets the drug kit, and then I can go off and start a line and then come back for drugs later.
Yeah, and I think if we'd done it with our kits at uni, we might have handled it slightly different as well, because they were much more modular as well. But at the end of the day, it was a matter of slowing down, taking a breath, looking at the scene, and working out where things would best go. And that was the real value for us.
Yeah. Managing big scenes is never easy. I'd still say it's probably one of my weaker points. So, because everyone's different, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So apart from that, what else have we got to talk about?
You've
just finished uni.
not quite. Only for the year. Don't tease me. I've got one more year to go.
Oh no!
and let me just say, if anyone's listening who wants to do the double degree over 4 years, it's great, but you'll get tired. It's exhausting.
So you're doing both nursing and paramedic placements.
That's right. So this semester, I'm doing a split placement. In maternity, which is a paramedic unit, so obstetric and paediatric emergencies. So I'm at Calvary John James doing postnatal work, special care nursery and birthing suite. And then after 2 weeks of that, we're also heading over to Calvary Hospital Emergency Department for the last week of that placement as well. So that's a paramedic placement in hospital, which is a feature that is so useful. Otherwise, I never would have been exposed to any obstetric emergencies whatsoever.
Yeah, look, I mean, that was one, I'd say that was one limitation of my program, was we did the birthing maternity lady, where someone pushes the cloth baby out with their hand, as I'm sure everyone's done at some point, but we never did a dedicated maternity placement. If you got a birth pre-hospital on your placements, then goodo.
You were a god amongst men.
Well, that's it. I think it happened to about three of us.
Yeah.
And still waiting on that first pre-hospital birth.
Yeah, exactly. And they're great when they come. As jobs go, they're great. And things, as I understand it, tend to go very well. They tend not to be complicated. But even having never actually participated in a normal birth is a huge setback for a student, especially when they're doing a maternity unit.
Absolutely. And exposure's half the battle.
That's right. And we're also doing strictly paramedic placements as well. So I'm still doing more placements with the ACT Ambulance Service, especially in January, another week at Dixon Station as well. And next year, I think we've got like 16 weeks of placement, so it's probably time to quit my job.
Wow, yeah.
So I can do that.
Probably.
Yeah.
That sounds a little bit intense.
So worth it, though. Oh, definitely worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. So, How's Canberra Ambulance set up now? Are they still, back when I was at university, they were all double intensive care cars?
So they've still got that legacy going on. And I think they still probably have the most ICPs of any service in Australia. They're everywhere. You're never more than 6 feet from an ICP. But they also are now a two-tier system. So they do now have AP cars, they call them, which are two entry-level paramedics working together. So that seems to work fairly well for them. As far as I can tell, it's not a terribly complicated change, but there are always, I think, a few issues to iron out when you go through that kind of change. And it's still a tiered system that's evolving over time. But at the end of the day, what that means is that applying for ACT Ambulance, you would go in as an entry-level paramedic, and then it's on merit that you get upgraded to ICP from now on as well.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. And I think as a graduate, that makes things just a little bit less daunting, not having to worry about immediately training to be an ICP the moment you get into a job. I have a chance to become a good ambulance paramedic first.
Oh, good. Mm. Good. I mean, yeah, the ICPs that stick out in my head never really touched their advanced kit. They just did the basics really, really well, and that's...
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly what I've seen in some of my better mentors as well. Being able to do the basics really, really well is something that I'm aiming for.
Good. How have you found the mentorship amongst?
Pretty good. Pretty good. So ACT Ambulance have a really good working culture, I think. Certainly compared to my own workplace, everybody's much happier. Everybody's very satisfied with their jobs. They're totally happy to work with students most of the time. So as mentorship goes, it's really good. And I've been to a couple of really difficult jobs with them, and the level of teamwork and support for one another is just outstanding, as far as I can tell. So, yeah, totally happy to be doing placements with them.
Lovely.
Yeah. And with that, I should probably run away, dude.
Yeah, I think you've got to go somewhere. Okay,
yeah.
So thanks for coming and talking, David. It's been a pleasure. Hopefully this podcast is more successful than our last attempt.
Yeah, you did remember to press record this time.
I hope so. Yes, we have been recording. Lovely.
That's outstanding.
All right, mate. I'll catch you later. Have a good one.
All right. Cheers, Mitch.
Bye.
See ya.
Just a quick post-editing note from me. I have placed the proceedings and abstracts for the SPA conference up on the Downstairs Care Out There website. You can find them there. It's just a link to the Journal of Paramedics Australasia. The Journal of Paramedics Australasia, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a free open access journal produced here in Australia that is quite a good read for those of you looking for something to fill your shift with. I'd highly recommend it. This podcast was recorded before the New Year, so I'll just take this opportunity to say Happy New Year to everyone, and hopefully you'll stick around with us for 2015. I'm looking to expand the... So whether you're joining us for the first time on this one or whether you've been a listener from the start, thank you. I hope you're having a good New Year. I hope Christmas was good to you all. And I will have another podcast up shortly.